Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. This morning, in this first hour, we'll be talking with a man who has been called the leading academic on the politics of technology. His name is Langdon Winner, and he is professor of political science in the Department of Science and Technology Studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. That's in Troy, New York. He also serves as co-director of the newly founded Center for Cultural Design. He's taught at a number of other institutions. He's lectured widely throughout the U.S. and Europe. Is the author of a book that we actually discussed on this program and is still available if you'd like to read some of his writing. The title of the book is The Whale and the Reactor, A Search for Limits in an Age of High Technology. It's available in a paperback edition published by University of Chicago Press. He is past president of the Society for Philosophy and Technology. Also, in the late 60s and 70s, was a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and contributed articles on rock and roll to the New Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians and also the Encyclopedia Britannica. He's here visiting the campus. We're pleased that he could spend a little time with us and talk. And as we talk, always on these programs, questions, comments from listeners are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that people are brief as possible so that we can keep moving and get in as many different people as possible. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much.
It's good to be here, David.
Human beings have, as far as we know, for a lot of our history, made tools and used them to modify our environment. And we still are doing that. And something that perhaps we don't often acknowledge is that that's not a one-way relationship. That's a two-way relationship. The tools end up modifying us. And if you think about the kind of tools that we use now, is there a fundamental difference in, certainly there's a difference in our ability to modify the environment, but is there in that relationship between us and the tools and what we do with them and what they do to us, is that fundamentally different now than it was, let's say, 100 years ago?
Well, I think the big changes began about 100, 150 years ago when technologies became systematic and brought into people's lives new kinds of commitments, constraints, responsibilities. And I think that's a different step in human history than the simple kind of use of a tool, let's say an axe, a hammer, and so forth. You can pick it up and put it down. If you, let's say, have extended complex transportation systems, production systems, communication systems, you get into social and political commitments and constraints, one can say, that bind what we do and largely shape our lives. And we sort of negotiate around this, maneuver around this, sometimes even forgetting the forces that act upon us.
It seems that now sometimes in the way we think about technology, particularly when something new comes along, there is a sense of inevitability about it.
Yeah.
As if it was something that it's going to be there, it's going to be with us almost whether we like it or not, in spite of whatever efforts that we might make to say, do we want this or not, or would we want to change this? Why is it that we do seem to react to it that way?
Yeah. Well, I think that the idea of inevitability, that something must happen, that it's sort of foreordained, is part of the language of technology in our time. We see these various kinds of changes, you know, the internet, the new electronics, HDTV, and so forth, sweeping over us. People are rushing out now, let's say, to buy.
It sounds like your headphones might be turned up very loud.
Maybe.
Let me just take a look.
Turn them down. Yeah. Let's get rid of that inevitability. That's better. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I should have briefed you about this. Yeah. This is a real live moment of live radio, ladies and gentlemen.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, the other way to look at it is I've been so hard on it that technology doesn't like me. but, you know, I think one thing that one can say about this idea that things, let's say technological developments, inevitably happen is that there is sort of strong social coalitions that form. And that is sort of impressively bring change into our lives. And the The thing that strikes me as important for people to take note of is that very often the idea of inevitability suggests that you have no power to negotiate, that the future has been foreclosed.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that's happened in my life recently as I've gotten involved in a variety of citizen movements is to take on things that were pronounced as done deals, inevitables, this is going to happen, you know, get ready, and so forth. And you say, well, we can modify this, we can change it, maybe even stop it. And very often, if people are clever and change the terms of the debate, capture the language of the debate, the outcomes look very much different than they did when the first, let's say, promotional announcements were made.
Mm-hmm. I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about more about maybe your personal feeling about technology, because I don't want people to get the wrong idea about you and think that somehow you're an anti-technologist, you're
yeah.
a Luddite, because I'm sure that there are people have thrown those sorts of things
yeah.
at you over time, and I think I don't think that's a fair characterization.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How do you think about technology?
Well, my route into this is rather unusual. I was a small-town boy from California, went to the big university, Berkeley, mm-hmm. studied political theory, and had a variety of experiences that I describe in the book The Whale and the Reactor, which convinced me that everything that I'd been studying in political history, political theory, political philosophy, was resonant and present in the realm of technical things, technical devices, technical systems, the technical professions and so forth. In other words, that they were social and political forms. And I sometimes say that I'm a kind of one-trick pony. And what I do is take the rich language of politics, which has existed in the West since the Greeks and around the world for a good long time as well, and use that to interpret technological systems, devices, and choices. So I look at technologies for what they do to influence our freedom or lack of freedom, what they have to do with division of goods in societies covered by notions of justice, mm-hmm. What they have to do with power and authority, for example. And from that standpoint, on occasion, what I do is say, well, I like this package we're likely to get here, but I don't like that, and I'm fully prepared to oppose it, tooth and nail. So I can give you some examples of that. Well, but that's basically what I do.
Well, let me invite you to give some examples of either some technological package that you'd say, well, this is pretty good. I think I can get behind that. And then something else that you would say, now this one, no, I would disagree.
Yeah. Well, I can give you an example from the region where I live and recent victories. I moved to a place called Columbia County in the Hudson River Valley of New York about 15 years ago. And I decided to get involved in local politics, and particularly politics that had to do with the relationship between economics and sustainability, basically. It turns out that region of the country, which is sort of down and out in an industrial sense, still has lots of open land. Some of the farms are still in production, and you have new people moving in with new ideas about, let's say, organic farming, community-supported agriculture, local production, and so forth. So the idea began to emerge that we could sort of reinvent the economy of the Hudson River Valley around notions of environmentally sustainable economies and technologies. Solar energy, wind are included in this also. And in the late 1990s, along came a proposal from a Swiss cement plant, St. Lawrence, owned by Holcim in Geneva, saying they were going to build an enormous $350 million coal-fired cement plant. And this, by the way, was proposed as inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And the rhetoric was, well, everyone supports this, the business communities, the politicians, it's going to create lots of jobs, it's going to create lots of economic revitalization in the community. And at first I bought this argument, by the way. I'd written a book many years ago on notions of autonomous technology, and I thought, well, this is one. We're stuck with this thing. But a handful of people, in the beginning about a dozen, said, we're going to stop this. And they went around to church basements and firehouses and people's living rooms talking about this. And eventually they came out against the plant explicitly. And to make a very long story short, after a 6-year-long battle, the plant did not get the crucial permit for construction. So we won that battle. And now the existing positive efforts to establish local co-ops, organic farms, policies of community revitalization in a sustainable mode have returned, and this is what we are doing. So that's the kind of contrast I would draw.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Langdon Winner. He's professor of political science in the Department of Science and Technology Studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. That's in Troy, New York, where he serves as co-director of the newly founded Center for Cultural Design. And as he has explained, he's done a lot of writing and thinking about the politics of technology. That's what he's really known for. He's here visiting the campus, gave a talk yesterday.
Mm-hmm. And another one today.
Mm-hmm. And do you have the information on that?
Yeah, it's at 4:00 at an art museum on campus. Maybe we can find out.
All right.
But the topic is information technology and the dream of democratic renewal. So I'll be exploring the penchant of Americans whenever from the early 19th century when a new technology arises. They not only say, oh, it's going to produce new economic benefits, but also that it will revitalize civic culture, make us better able to participate, enhance equality, and so forth. So I'll be looking at sort of 200 years of that.
So when the proliferation of the personal computer and other devices like that and the internet and the promises that were made about how this was going to be a great democratizing kind of technology—
right.
That was not the first time someone looked at
new
technology and said, oh, this is going to be the greatest thing, and look at all the wonderful things it's going to do.
Yeah. It goes back to, let's say, the Erie Canal. In the early history of the American Republic, if they built a railroad or a canal, the opening day would have to be, of course, the 4th of July, because these technological systems were celebrations of American freedom and democracy, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I think the major problem, which you begin to see early in the history of the Republic, which continues to this day, including, let's say, communication system, the internet, and so forth, is people are so excited about the wonderful uses of the railroad train or the canal boat or the internet that they fail to look at the underlying institutional dynamics, which almost inevitably, to use that word, because inevitable in the sense that social forces come together to form very strong coalitions to change the situation, you get very strong concentrations of institutionalized power, usually large corporations that rule the day. And this is true right now, for example, in debates in Congress about the net neutrality rule and whether this will become part of U.S. law. For those in the audience that don't know about this, this is the idea that we'll sort of segment the internet into sort of those who can pay for high-speed service and the rest of the peons that just sort of, will have to watch their YouTube videos load in about 5 minutes or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an issue about equality and inequality and power, And this, I would say, has been true about technological choices throughout the history of the country.
So it was not so much an issue that people made promises about these technologies that couldn't be accomplished. It rather was there were competing interests and that one set of interests continued to seem to win out.
That's right. And the thing that I would add to that conclusion is that the utopian dreams about technology, which see the good outcomes as the inevitable ones, actually disempower people. Because what you really have to do is be there early and in a continuing way, trying to shape these systems, these devices, in ways that really are, let's say, democratic. And that if you do not, I understand this is an AM radio station, right?
Mm-hmm.
I consider maybe you do too. We won't need to ask you that question. But as far as I'm concerned, the AM radio dial is controlled by these big media firms, has become a kind of political sewer. you know, and I, you know, the talk show hosts and so forth that you hear up and down the dial 24 hours a day, essentially hate radio. You know, this was no accident. This was not inevitable for AM radio, which was in the early days in the 1920s, for example, seen as education and culture and music and courses that students could take and so forth. And now we get, Mike Savage and Rush Limbaugh and so forth, essentially an ongoing education, indeed, in who to hate and how to express that hatred in American social life.
Mm. Well, we're still trying to do it the old way.
The old way. That's good. That's good.
We love radio. We wouldn't be here.
I love radio too. But I'll tell you, I now almost always listen to XM.
Well, we're doing our best to continue to pioneer in the old-fashioned way. I'm not sure how much longer we can continue to do that, but as long as we can, we'll keep doing it. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's talk with them in nearby community of Belgium, our line number for the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I hope your guest listens to you on the Internet because you are much better than the rest. But let's go on to what we are talking about. Your discussion today is about technology and technology and politics. There seems to be an area where I think we could do a whole lot more and help our country and everything. And Mr. Inge has heard me rattle on about this more than once, about the use of hydrogen to solve many of the problems that are being involved today, not only in the environment, but also give us new technology to sell to the rest of the world and help our economy, meaning the United States. Maybe I'm pretty ethnocentric there, but still, it seems though we have the technology to produce the hydrogen. South of Champaign-Urbana there, we're going to start producing hydrogen and to use for general electrical power, but we can also use it to power our cars and fuel cells, which are things we know about. All of these things we've known for a long time. Why can't we gather this technology together to improve the conditions not only in the world, but also in the United States?
Well, it's not a
technology that I'm familiar with or expert in. People that I've talked to about it tell me that the enthusiasms for it, let's say 5 or 6 years ago, were somewhat misplaced because hydrogen is basically a way of transferring energy, is not a new source of energy. In other words, you have to have something to generate the hydrogen, and then you can carry it usefully to a place where it can power your car or whatever. I do think the general implication of the question is, what are we going to do in the era in which petroleum is going to become scarce and expensive, and in which burning coal is going to be a risky proposition, and in which, there are a variety of proposals, wind, solar, nuclear, and so forth. There are a whole nest of problems as we enter into this new era. And my own first thought on this is that we have been profligate in our use of energy. And one thing we need to do before we explore any new systems of either energy transfer or production is to look at energy efficiency and demand reduction. I think, the way we've been in my lifetime, I think my lifetime has been the most environmentally destructive generation in history. And we've been essentially, burning up the world's supply of petroleum to foster a lifestyle which is not sustainable. And one thing that would make a lot of sense right now is just to find ways in which we are wasteful and foolish in the way we use energy and cut that back drastically. And I think we could do that without harming our way of life, basically.
The point I'm getting at, sir, is that any more addition to carbon to our atmosphere, whether we want to consider that human activity has created global warming or not, but any increase in carbon in our atmosphere is going to be too much. We got to go negative, so we got to step to a new technology. The internal combustion engine has got to go its way. The fuel cell has to come along because we need to move in a more positive, negative direction of carbon emissions. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
thank you.
Well, I agree with that. I'm just not sure that hydrogen is the way to go because some energy has to be expended in order to produce the hydrogen.
Let's talk with someone else. This is a caller in Urbana, here where we are, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I had a question. Are you familiar with the podcasts that are available through iTunes University?
No, I'm not. I'm generally familiar with podcasting, but not those in particular. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Basically what it is you can download lectures that are being podcast for free.
Yeah.
Question I have, there's one group that came up that is trying to form a discussion group, you know, outside of the university setting, and set it up in the Second Life Forum as a way to kind of form a virtual discussion group. And I'm just curious if you know of any of examples where something like that has worked, or what kind of what you might have on that approach.
Yeah. Well, I don't know much about that directly. I don't live on Second Life. My first life is difficult enough. I have a student who did a study of uses of and institutions and practices of philanthropy on Second Life, where people would choose socially worthy causes, and in this kind of virtual realm, sponsor events, including virtual concerts, for example, where people could pay money for a ticket, in effect, and the money would go to a charitable cause. And applications of technology, uses of the internet and the digital realm to do this kind of thing, I celebrate. I think it's perfectly fine. And if that kind of thing is going to be used in the way that the caller is suggesting, I would just say, hooray, this sounds perfectly fine to me, and let's make it work. Okay.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your comments. I'll just say I can't hear anything very well, so there must be some technical issues. But thank you very much.
All right. Well, hopefully the callers can hear us and the people who are listening can hear us. Let me just mention real quick, because I raised the question about your talk today. I do indeed have the information. I want to make sure that people know
where it is.
Where it is. This is at this afternoon at 4:00 in the Knight Auditorium of Spurlock Museum, which is on South Gregory in Urbana. It's free and open to the public. This is an event in the Millercom series. Our guest this morning, Langdon Winter, talking about information technology and the dream of democratic renewal. Well, given the situation that seems to apply, and that is that we have this technology that is personal computers and other devices that let you have access to a lot of information in the internet, that maybe the kind of promises that people hoped for hadn't quite been realized, and commercial interest had, of course, rushed in and saw this as an opportunity to make money. Are the proverbial horses out of the barn on this, or is there anything at this point that could be done to try to recapture some of that initial optimism and potential that people saw?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I think the more positive and optimistic aspects, of the internet and digital communications is still, I think, the leading edge, and it's very hard, I think, at this point. Although they're trying very hard, for the large communications corporations to put the genie back in the bottle. But I think it's possible they could, with something like the Net Neutrality Act and other ways in which you could see concentration of the main sites that people visit, and essentially that the concentrated control of what people are likely to do online is established. The other thing I think that could ruin the internet, and could well happen, is already happening, is that it will become could become a place of universal electronic surveillance. So we already have a country in which all of our phone calls and all of our email is placed under surveillance by the National Security Agency. And this law right now is up before Congress, renewal of the FISA Act, and the whole question of whether the telecom companies who have been allowing this surveillance to take place will receive amnesty for allowing this practice to happen. So here's a directly political case about technology. We have the Fourth Amendment, which explicitly forbids this kind of search without a warrant. And yet for the past 4 years or so, we've had this in electronic form universally in American society. And people get the sense that everything they're doing online is being watched either by government or corporate spies. Then people might say, well, this wonderful promise of the internet has now evaporated. We've got to find something else.
We're at our midpoint here. We'll talk some more with our guest, Langdon Winner. He's professor of political science at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, has written a lot about the politics of technology. He's lectured widely throughout the U.S. and Europe, taught at a number of places. If you'd like to read some of his writing, you might look for his book, The Whale and the Reactor, A Search for Limits in an Age of High-Tech Technology, published by the University of Chicago Press. And as mentioned a moment ago, he'll be giving a talk this afternoon on the U of I campus at 4 at the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory, and it's free and open to the public. Anyone who'd like to attend should feel welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Also, if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. Otherwise, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the first, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to just ask you about something else, and this really was one of the things that you were talking about yesterday, and that's about computers in education,
yeah,
and in schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that some people have argued that it would be a great step forward for a variety of reasons if we could make sure that all students in the United States, and perhaps all children everywhere, whether they had the means or not, to have access to a computer, in fact, perhaps to have their own. And people have launched these plans or suggested these ideas that, well, we should just give one. Give one to every,
yeah,
school child in the United States, or we could go to the developing world and we could give a computer to every kid, that would be a great leg up for them. It would be great for economic development of their country and so forth. What,
yeah,
do you think of that idea?
Well, this is an old idea. In 1909, Thomas Edison was approached by a government official from Australia who said, your motion picture machine could really be a wonderful thing in education. And Thomas Edison got tremendously excited about that. And so he began producing educational films, some 6,000 films, for the 19 million school children of the United States. And he said, this would revitalize education and replace books. And the children would be so excited by movies, education, that you couldn't keep the children out of the classroom, even if you surrounded the building with the police, right? And this dream of revitalizing education through infusions of new technology has come wave after wave for the last 100 years. And most of the stuff you would find in the closets of school systems, for example, these are the real museums of educational technology, the junk they no longer use, language laboratory, equipments, tape strips, and so forth. And, my feeling is, well, if we had, let's say, low-cost, usable laptops for kids, that'd be perfectly fine, more power to those that want to do this. But what bothers me is the sort of monomania that comes with this. So you say, what do children need first and foremost? I think that's the real question. Well, maybe they need to have a decent meal in the middle of the day. Maybe they need to have a decent classroom. Maybe they need to have a caring adult, especially in their younger years of education. Bringing them along. And a lot of the models that I've seen of, let's say, one laptop per child, which I like to rename No Laptop Left Behind, sort of say, well, all the children need ultimately is the laptop. They'll be connected to the net. They'll be able to, do photos and so forth. And, it's not that I don't like those powers. I think the children should be, prevented from having access to them. But this kind of monomaniacal view of what education involves, especially the needs of children, really, and the needs of parents and communities in the education process, I think is the thing we really ought to be looking at, rather than just some fancy $200 or $100 box.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk with someone else here. We have a caller in Champaign. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I would like to know what your guest thinks about the work and thought and writings of Jacques Ellul.
Uh-huh.
I'd be surprised if he wasn't familiar with this. I have owned a book by this particular man for 30 years and have tried to read it at least 10 times. Which one is it? The Technological Society.
Yeah.
I find this to be the most startling thing I have almost ever read. It has transformed my consciousness, if I may use that hackneyed phrase. It has given me a new way of looking at everything, and I must say it is somewhat depressing. On the other hand, it is extremely liberating. I'd be very interested to know what you think of this man's work. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jacques Ellul, for those in the audience that don't know who he was a sociologist and theologian who lived his whole life in Bordeaux, France. For a while was a mayor of Bordeaux, so he was a civic activist. He wrote on law, technology, the city, and he wrote a number of books on ethics, theology. He was a Protestant theologian. And the book the caller mentioned in particular, The Technological Society, was the one book in my education when I was trying to formulate this project that I mentioned at the very beginning here, trying to find a way to use political theory to talk about technological things. A friend of mine said, well, have you read this book, The Technological Society? And I said, no, what is it? And he said, well, just go out and get a copy. So I got a copy that afternoon and didn't put it down until 8 a.m. the following morning. It was a riveting discussion. Essentially what the book says is that in the past there had been cultural, social, and political constraints upon what Ellul calls la technique, which is the quest for the best way to do anything. And he says in modern social upheavals, the revolutions of the modern age, those limits, those barriers were lifted. For example, you had the destruction of the crafts guilds, which limited production rather than advanced production. And he says, with this, society was sort of taken over by this mania to develop tools and instruments and systems on and on and on. And in Ellul's view, this becomes sort of all-enveloping. It becomes really what we are about. And contending with this book and others similar to it became a major part of my own development in thinking about this, because as the caller suggested, the challenge of Jacques Ellul's thinking is quite profound and rather frightening. Mm-hmm. The world he describes, I think many people just find unacceptable. By the way, there's some interesting films based upon Ellul's thought, the trilogy of Kotze films by Godfrey Reggio, Koyaanisqatsi, Poikkatsi, Nakwaikatsi are the most recent one, and they are cinematic representations of the world that Jacques Ellul described. For those that don't want to read the book, they can watch it in cinematic form.
And you, I believe you had some role to play in the making of the first of those.
Yeah, the first films. Of them. Yeah, Koyaanisqatsi. Godfrey Reggio approached me with his plans, and eventually the rushes, you know, the film clips of the film. And wanted to know what I, as somebody who'd written about autonomous technology, that book is to some extent an interpretation of Jacques Ellul, Lewis Mumford, Karl Marx, and mm-hmm. so forth. And so I did have, you know, a minor role in the shaping of that movie.
And as I recall, Koyaanisqatsi means something like world out of balance.
Yeah, life.
Something
out of
like balance. Life out of balance. That's mm-hmm. better. Life out of balance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I guess that leads to the question about, well, what sort of things can we do, maybe in small ways, but what sort of things can we do to try to get our lives more in balance?
Well, I think, you know, one thing that occurs to me in this era in which we're becoming aware of the crisis of global climate change, the need for renewable energy, energy efficiency, sustainable technologies, and so forth, mm-hmm. is that there was a trial run, I'm sure you remember it quite well, of all of this in the 1970s, the energy crisis, the OPEC oil embargo, the initiatives in Congress and by President Jimmy Carter to take us on a road in which we would achieve energy independence and also achieve a kind of what would now be called a green society that would respond to the ecological crisis and so forth. That was well on the way. And then along came the presidency of Ronald Reagan. And he proclaimed that there was an oil glut and just get back producing as usual. But thinking back on it now, what people were imagining some 30 years ago of a industrial society, a modern technological society that would be transformed to become energy conserving, less resource intensive, sort of changing its basic infrastructures and ways of approaching production and consumption. It was a good start on, made on that, and then it was just forgotten, right? And I think what, you know, the best and most innovative people that I see these days are those doing, you know, sustainable design, innovations for the least well-provided people on the planet, the other 90%, and so forth. So there's a lot of possibilities for creativity, including technological change, which have been, I think, been staring us in the face for quite a long while. But we have, you know, rejected this because our ideas, of, especially, I think, of consumerism, mm-hmm. have been so beguiling that we haven't wanted to face up to what I think are our responsibilities as citizens of the planet.
Well, this, I guess I find myself coming back again to this particular problem. That is, as far as the looking at the way we live, our patterns of consumption, and our enthusiasm with new things is certainly part of that. Mm-hmm. As new things come along and we say, well, we've got to have the new thing. The new thing takes energy and resources to produce. Then the old thing, well, yeah, we just got to throw that away. And then we need to have energy to maintain the certain lifestyle and, you know, everything that, that goes with that, including our disturbing tendency to measure our well-being by the stuff that we have. It seems to me that you know, a lot, what worries a lot of people is it's like the railroad train roaring down the tracks.
Yeah.
You know, and you'd better not stand in the way because you're going to get run over.
Yeah.
That's how do you even start to slow the train down a little bit, given the fact, given how big it is, and how much you know, force there is behind it.
Yeah. Well, I think what you do is just look at good ideas for, let's say, trimming carbon gas emissions, for achieving energy efficiency, changing lifestyles and social habits. I mean, one thing that strikes me, for example, I talked to Hazel Henderson, an old friend of mine, on the telephone. She no longer travels to conferences to give talks. She's often invited. She's an environmental mm-hmm. activist, has written a lot about the solar economy and so forth. So what she does is uses communications, satellite communications, to project her talks on a big screen, let's say in Vienna. She's somewhere in Florida. And she just says, I got to the point where I didn't want to be expending fuel, jet fuel, to communicate with people, you know, who want to hear me speak. And it seems to me actually the trade-off there between the digital capability, communications capability, and the ways in which we burn fuel to travel, that's an interesting trade-off which no one has wanted to explore, but mm-hmm. I think could be quite fruitful.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Langdon Winter. He's professor of political science at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. That's in Troy, New York. He's also co-director of the Center for Cultural Design there and does a lot of writing and thinking about the politics of technology. If you'd like to read some of his work, you could look for his book, The Whale and the Reactor, A Search for Limits in an Age of High Technology, and it is published by the University of Chicago Press. He's here visiting the campus, gave a talk yesterday. We'll give another one today, and that's open to anybody who would like to attend, talking on information technology and the dream of democratic renewal this afternoon at 4. That's in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus.
There's another one on Thursday. I'm not sure if that's being advertised, but I'm going to also talk on innovation in China. In recent years, I've had an opportunity to visit China on three occasions, just go to conferences, talk to people in universities. And most recently, when I've been there, the big push by the institutions has been, from the officials that give speeches and so forth, is that China can no longer be the workshop of the world. It needs to innovate. Mm-hmm. And this strikes me as a very interesting institutional and technological and educational problem, because they have an authoritarian state, basically. I teach in a program on technological innovation. I'm always telling my students, think outside the box. Take risks. Don't be afraid of failure. A colleague of mine in the business school at Rensselaer, I once asked him, I said, what do innovators do? He said, they learn what the rules are in a given field of enterprise, and then they break them. That's what innovators do. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that that is so far from at least the present practices of Chinese institutions, where people are not trusting, not willing to take risks, that this current goal of China, not just to be a workshop, but to be truly an innovative part of the global economy, is very problematic. So mm-hmm. somewhere on the university campus, I'll be talking about this on Thursday as mm-hmm. well.
Just that, I guess that raises another question, and I wonder if you think about how much you think about this, the problem of countries like China or India or others that are just on the brink of perhaps even in explosive kinds of,
yeah.
of economic development,
and
what that means, particularly if for their citizens, their level of consumption gets anywhere near what ours
yeah.
is.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of people would say, well, as far as the earth is concerned, that breaks the bank.
Yeah.
It just can't.
It does.
It can't happen.
Yeah. If you bring everybody on the planet up to the level of, let's say, a middle class lifestyle, consumption style, it would take 4.5 planet Earths to do that. And, I think that, we in America have very little to say about this, actually. So when I visit China, for example, I have a good friend, research colleague now, and he was agonizing about whether or not to buy a car. You know, his family has a little money, and he finally got a car, you know. So I said, his name is Yuru. I said, Yuru, you know, you're the person. You're the one that's going to ruin the planet now. I warned you against doing this. But, of course, it's just a joke, because the level of consumption for we Americans and our wasteful, environmentally destructive habits are, don't give us a platform to stand up on to give moral advice to developing countries. If we seriously embarked upon, let's say, new best practices, mm-hmm. which I think to some extent we are doing, that would be good. We could say, well, here's what really advanced technological societies look like, advanced devices and systems and so forth. Good. They say, no, so you should emulate this that we are now doing, right? But it turns out that, we're not actually very far along on that. And in India and China, they just want to, achieve the good life,
Mm-hmm. How do you go about convincing people, though, that it is possible to implement these best practices and at the same time live the good life? I think that a lot of people make that argument that moving to a more sustainable kind of economy, greater energy efficiency, being more intelligent in the way that we live, does not necessarily mean that we're going to have to somehow give up the way that we live, or that somehow our lives will be less comfortable or less satisfying, and that our needs won't be taken care of.
Yeah. Well, that's a serious question. First of all, I unless asked, I tend not to preach. So, when I go to China, I will give talks on my work, but then I just listen to what their hopes and dreams and aspirations are. And if they say, well, what do you think about this? I'd say, well, have you thought about the fact that if you look outside the window, you see this gray haze and you can sort of feel it in the lungs with every breath that you take? What part of your economic development strategy is going to involve cleaning up the coal pollution and so forth? Then you have an opportunity to begin talking about other approaches and other ways of using energy, for example. And I am fully convinced that there are ways in which we could, let's say, have solid programs of demand reduction for our intensive use of energy and natural resources. Mm-hmm. to develop technologies and systems that do this. Also, you know, change our social preferences to make, let's say, community life, sociability more important than just consuming lots of stuff, right? That this is the path that's open to us, but we don't have much authority for proposing it to the rest of the world right now, even though we see the implications of their demands on the biosphere. We don't have much of a leg to stand on if we're not doing this in a kind of open, concerted way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, I guess, there is the challenge. We can leave the rest of the world aside for a while and just think about how it is we even start doing that at home.
Yeah. Well, I think one thing that people are going to have to do, if asked, and you are asking, is focus more of their energies locally, local production, including food, limiting their travel and just trying to find sources of satisfaction and enjoyment that don't involve, you know, massive expenditures of fossil fuels, this kind of thing. A very interesting book, I think, from a friend of mine in the upstate New York area is The Long Emergency by James Howard Kunstler. I don't know if you've read that book. He sort of imagines what's the world going to be like in years ahead when we essentially run out of cheap fuel. And that's what he describes. Is that we're going to have to reacquaint ourselves with the communities in which we live and make that the sources of satisfaction.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll see if we can get them in.
Good.
First is someone here in Champaign County where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. In the broad strokes we're speaking of, I feel obliged to point out all this talk about China. There was a study that was done in the UK just recently that I think hasn't gotten enough mention here, and that's the fact that one-sixth of their carbon production is basically predicated on U.S. Consumption.
Yeah.
So it's not those guys over there exceeding at all. I mean, it's much more of a whole system, as it were. And I really think that needs to be stressed.
Well, one thing, you know, when you go into a Walmart and you buy something that says made in China and you say it's ridiculously cheap, wow, I'll buy that. An interesting question would be to ask, shouldn't that cost more? And if you trace down, let's say, the production and transportation system that brought that to you, one thing we've done is to export to China the environmentally destructive practices that bring you, you know, that wonderful $2 item on the Walmart shelf, which ought to, at this point, raise, you know, serious practical and moral questions for our consumer habits.
Yeah, it's interesting that Lawrence Summer, who's looked at as a guru now in economics, was actually explicitly quoted, well, it came from his desk, he says he didn't, which was that it was consciously World Bank practice to export dirty technological practices and factories to third world countries where their lifespan is shorter anyway. That's gruesome and I think infrequently dwelled on. I'm glad there's a science, technology, and society program here, and I wish they would be doing more events, and I'm glad to hear you. Thank you.
All right. Yep. We'll try real quick line two, Champaign. Hello.
Yes. I certainly agree with you that people in the United States certainly don't have a moral platform for talking to people like in China and India about how their technology ought to develop and how their society ought to develop. But I think we do have a platform for giving practical advice. And the people in California have done this in a way for the rest of us in the United States. They were the first ones to go to drive-in theaters and drive-in churches and highways everywhere. And they proceeded to discover that this led to a kind of life that many of them didn't really like. And so they have also led us in trying to go back in the kind of directions that you're talking about. And it seems to me that the United States as a whole and people from America, like yourself, who have opportunities to talk to people in places like China, can say, you know, look, sure, you can go ahead and and buy cars as fast as you can afford them, but is that going to lead you to the kind of society that you really want, or is it going to lead you to the kind of problems that we have in the United States, where, for example, parents spend a lot of their time in cars, confined in cars, driving their children around to various activities and doing their errands and so forth, and the community life that we used to enjoy by walking down the street while people were sitting on their porches in order to do our errands has gone the way of all flesh.
Oh, All I can say is I agree completely with that caller's comment. Thank you.
Well, we're at the point here, I think we're going to finish. Any last sort of thought you'd like to leave with folks?
Yeah, I think one thought that I would like to leave, which was the one we really began with, David, which is if you hear something obnoxious coming down the pike at you and somebody tells you it's inevitable, a done deal, that you have no negotiating power, please go away, you know, this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That one thing that's still possible in our free society, in our democracy, is to join with other citizens to try to shape technological choices in ways that produce an agreeable way of life, whether it's going towards sustainability or, improving transit and educational systems, whatever it is. In other words, to become involved rather than just sort of a passive recipient of technological impress. Hmm.
Our guest for this hour, Langdon Winters, professor of political science at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, Troy, New York. He'll be talking on information technology and the dream of democratic renewal this afternoon at 4 in the Knight Auditorium. This is a Millercom event, and it is free and open to the public. Also, you might want to look at his book, The Whale and the Reactor, A Search for Limits in an Age of High Technology, University of Chicago Press. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.